This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Jessica Curry, and oh my goodness, it's so nice to have a chance to catch up.
It's so nice to talk to you. It's just like always like the highlight of my week or my month to hear your lovely voice.
Oh, you're so nice. You know, it's been a couple of years since everybody's gone to the Rapture, and there was just so much excitement about a new soundtrack from you, and I really understand why, because your music is just so special. How much time did you have to write all of this gorgeous music for So Let Us Melt?
Yeah, it was quite a different experience, actually, because the whole development cycle for So Let Us Melt was only a year, and we had nearly 3 years on Rapture, so everything felt so condensed in comparison to the time that we had on Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. So the music was really, really pressured. Design came in quite late on the game because it was our first virtual reality game. So we were learning every day in this very, very short period of time. And suddenly the music was due, and I couldn't have written it any earlier because there were so many design issues to solve. And I've never worked so intensely on a game music project as I did on this. And in a way, it kind of forced me to just do it. And that can have, it's not my ideal way of working, but actually there is such an energy in the music. And I look back at the time that I was writing it, I think that was partly the energy that I had to generate because of a very really short time frame. And so, yeah, it spilled into the music.
Well, what I've noticed about it, listening to the soundtrack just start to finish, is that it's got such a consistent style and a consistent voice, and it just works as a whole entire concert piece, which I guess would be kind of a side effect from working on it so quickly. You know, you hear about composers who write a movement of a concerto and then 5 years later they come back to it, and it has this kind of disjointed quality to it. But this, I guess because you were writing it, just bam, it just hit the start button and go.
I'm always so lucky with Dan Pinchbeck, husband and creative director, because he really understands music, and he certainly understands my music. And he always says, the first thing he says to me is, I want this game to make sense if you can't see it visually. I want you to tell the story through the music. And that in itself gives it a context and a meaning and it rolls on, I think. And he's just really, really good at leaving space for music as well. So it's a really musical journey through 10 million years of this virtual reality world. And it's so visually beautiful and so immersive. And it was just an amazing opportunity to write music for such an optimistic game. I think that was really different for the Chinese Room as well, because we are known, as you know, Kate, for our, you know, more, you know, deep dives into the human psyche and what it means to be living in this world and the challenges of being human. And actually Dan said, I want to write a fun game that's about friendship and communication, and especially with everything that's going on in the world at the moment. He said, I want to put something out there that is hopeful. And the music, I hope, really reflects that.
Oh, it absolutely does. And what's so cool about it is that the story is, I mean, I know you can tell it better than I can. It's about 98, a custodian that is part of a whole group, thousands of them, or 1,500 of them anyway, getting a planet ready for humans. And 98 has a little helper, a little drone helper. But I think what's so amazing about it is that music is what brings the world to life. And the custodians sing to each other. And my first thought was, well, that's the way Aslan brought Narnia to life. And then it's a wonderful scene where the four kids are trying to imagine what he's going to create by the way he sings. And I wonder if that was an inspiration at all for...
It wasn't, but you're absolutely... It's just occurred to me, you're so right. And again, as a composer, that was such an amazing opportunity to be given by a creative director to say, this world is sung into being. And immediately, of course, all these amazing melodies started popping into my head. And I must have tried out about 9,000 kind of main songs and then was trying them out on the team and the sound designer. And then I hit across one that is repeated throughout the final soundtrack. What I learned from Rapture is the music of Rapture had six main themes to represent the six main characters. Mm-hmm. And that had a strength and a beauty, but I also wanted to write a soundtrack that was really cohesive, where that one main theme was repeated in lots of different iterations, and it gains power because of that. The more you hear it, the more you play the game, and the further you go into the soundtrack. And I loved that opportunity to go, there is this one unifying theme.
What's so wonderful about that theme is that it's a melody anyone can sing. I mean, I keep hearing it in my head now, and I'm not a singer. You wouldn't want me to sing, but it's so simple and so heartfelt. And you're right, the way that you keep bringing it back and giving it different iterations through the score makes it just kind of grounding, I guess. It's really cool.
Thank you. So. It always means so much coming from you, because you know so much about music, and some compliments are definitely worth more than others, and yours are very, you know, very valuable. So thank you. Oh. Yeah, it was such a joy to me to write something positive. As you know, I'm a very emotional writer. It always comes from the heart, but I tend to access the more difficult emotions, I suppose, that I feel that I express through music. And this is probably the first time ever, and I'm 44 now, that I've written something that is so full of life and energy, and it makes me smile when I listen to it. And that's probably the first soundtrack that I can say that about, that I actually feel it's playful. And it was really, really interesting as a composer to be given the opportunity to write something with so much movement.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you brought in that astonishing choir, the London Voices, again for this recording. And did you know right off the bat that you were going to be writing for them and working for them?
Yeah, I absolutely had them in mind from the very beginning. I knew after Rapture there wasn't ever really going to be another choir that would cut the mustard for me. And I actually wrote the end title piece, which is called So Let Us Melt, with London Voices very, very much in my head. And they sang it in that way. I think it's probably one of the strongest pieces I've written, I feel. And they just are incredible. It's really challenging technically to sing that piece. It's a cappella, it's very exposed, it has quite a lot of complicated choral techniques in. And, you know, they just started singing it and you go, okay, you've got this. You know, I'm in a choir. It would take most choirs, you know, days, weeks, probably a couple of months to get their heads around it. And they are world-class musicians. And it is such an incredible honour. It's been the best few days of my year was being at Air Studios again, recording that soundtrack with the same gang. That was the amazing thing. I said to Isabel Griffiths, who's the orchestral booker, I want all the same players. I said to London Voices, I want all the same singers that sang on Rapture, whoever's available. And it was nearly everyone could do it. It just came together. And it had a feeling of a really beautiful reunion, and a lot of them weren't aware that I'd won the BAFTA, and I told them and they were so pleased.
Aww.
And again, several of the musicians said to me at the end, and Cleo Gould, who was the leader of the orchestra, she said, your sessions are so gentle in comparison, and she said, we never ever work with women composers, and she said, it's just so lovely. She said, you don't see us as machines, you see us as human beings, and you recognize that we are putting ourselves out there. It's not just, you know, we're amazing and don't need anything. Not many people say that was a lovely take, or, oh God, that was incredible. And I believe that they are giving something very, very deep of themselves when they play. It makes you really vulnerable to sing or to play. So those sessions just had a really gentle, loving quality that I think is absent from quite a lot of recording sessions.
I think so. It's got to be brutal, because if you think about it, the musicians don't have a lot of time to get into the music. Very often they're just sight reading it. And I mean, that speaks a lot to the quality of the musicians in the first place. But yeah. I think to be able to, well, first of all, I mean, it's got to be a privilege for them to be able to have the composer right there giving them direction and insight and that kind of thing. I mean, obviously, you never get that if you're singing Duruflay or Thomas Tallis or something like that.
But I think they are quite used to people barking at them, not all the time, but I think the sessions are so high pressure. Whereas I remember there were some publishing execs there for Rapture, and they were like, why are you telling them the story of the game? You're wasting time. And I was like, this isn't a waste of time. This is going to get a better performance out of them, especially with Rapture, when, you know, one of the scenes they were singing was there's a teenager holding a baby in her arms, and that it's the end of the world, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was setting this scene, and I truly believe, and I still believe, that that was a really good use of time. Even though they're going, well, you've spent 2 minutes doing that, that could have been recording. I believe that we would have done probably three takes and then got it. And actually, just spending some time human to human with those people is really, really valuable. So I don't regret running the sessions the way I run them, even though I think it's probably a little bit contentious.
Well, if the end result is anything like what you've got with So Let Us Melt, it's all obviously time well spent. And so what kind of direction did you give to the choir this time? I mean, did you just tell them that they were singing robots?
Well, I think what was really interesting is that I was really ill when I wrote this soundtrack, and I was on a lot of morphine. I was in a lot of pain. And in my morphine-induced haze, I thought it'd be a really good idea to make up a language.
I was going to ask you about that.
Only someone on prescription drugs could have thought this was a good idea. So I made up this, you know, quite crazy language. And then, of course, there was all the discussion about, oh, is that fee or fi, or is that tome or tomb? And that took up quite a lot of time, but it also created a massive amount of humour in the session. So it set us off on quite a good road. So it was really setting the visual scene for them. It's a lot more expensive to have the screen behind you at recording sessions. And this was a very, very tight budget, so they didn't have any images to work off. So they kind of relied on me to say, you know, we're zooming through space in this queue, and the world is being built, and flowers are exploding as you fly through. And yeah, I think it just really helps them to go, what? It's kind of like an actor of what is my motivation for this scene. You know,
sure.
I believe it gives us a little bit of depth to for them to know what they're singing about. But yeah, the language caused quite a lot of hilarity within the session.
I'll bet there is a really wonderful moments where they're sort of like, it's almost like pointillistic. They're kind of, it's almost like little dots of light, the way that you bounce the melody around in the choir. And that must have been kind of a challenging part of the session for them. I mean, they come in spot on, but I can imagine that.
This is the thing where I just couldn't believe that. It's one thing, like, as a choral singer, when I'm reading, especially in English, as I'm sight reading, you're already decoding the meaning of those words and the probability of what word is going to come next. And you kind of just understand it. And what I was fascinated by and so impressed by was their ability to sight read whilst they're reading a made up language that has no kind of contextual meaning, and yet they still manage just to absolutely knock it out of the park.
It's incredible. Did they play with the other musicians, or did you have two separate sessions?
We had two separate sessions.
Yeah, that probably makes for a better mix at the end, because then...
Definitely, yeah. And they're so used to doing that. And in fact, my sessions are normally quite connected in terms of who's playing at the same time. Like, we had the pianist in the same sessions as the orchestra, but often they're done, completely separately. But it was just... Yeah, nice people.
Yeah.
And that always means a lot to me, having that good atmosphere. It's a joy.
Well, in the video and just now in our conversation, you've mentioned that the Air Studio is really special. What do you love about it? What makes that one special above all others for you?
I remember walking in the first time when I was doing the Rapture sessions, and I'd never done a big session in my entire career. I didn't know what to expect. I'd been to some other studios to see other composers, and they were nice, when you go in, but it can be a bit snooty and a little bit, oh, you're lucky to be here. And I walked into Air, and it's just like being enveloped by a big, warm hug. They are at what I would call a working studio. It's not the name that matters to them, it's the fact that they take so much pride in looking after the musicians that are there, the composers, the engineers, the producers. There's an amazing cafe where the food is produced with so much love, and it's a lovely communal space where you're so likely to bump into someone extremely famous. Everyone's just chatting and accepting of who you are, and it's not snobby. I hate snobbery, and it feels like a very egalitarian place, and you earn your place there by being talented, and I think that's a really lovely thing. And people wear their talent very lightly there. There are some extraordinarily amazing players and performers that go through those doors, and yet everyone is just, behaving. If I could play the violin like that, I'd be like, listen to me, I'm playing my violin now in your face because I'm so good. I'll just have it with me. I'd have it strapped onto me constantly and just be showing off with it. But they're just amazing, lovely people. And I just think, yeah, it has a nurturing atmosphere, and that suited me very well. And they knew I was nervous, and they really looked after me as well that first time. They held my hand through it, and I will always appreciate that.
That really, I think, speaks volumes because you want to be in a place where you really are comfortable and you feel like you can do your best work without a lot of pressure from outside or feeling like you don't belong there. So that's
And
fantastic.
I quite famously insist on excellence, which gets me into quite some trouble in terms of it can be really difficult to work with somebody who's always going, this can be better, this has to be done again. It isn't easy. And I walked into Air and I felt at home in that those people who are there, if it's not perfect, they go, it's happening again. And there's a better way of doing this. They never say it's good enough, and I am really exacting, and I do insist on a really high standard. So to be around people where that was the norm as well, where people aren't resenting that or feeling upset or criticized by that, is really, really nice. I just thought, this is a world-class establishment where everyone is going, you have to be on your game. And when you walk through those doors, you're kind of, you're giving something important of yourself. So I really appreciated that attitude as well.
Oh, that sounds
I'm laughing
amazing.
at myself because I sound so horrendous. It's like fame, isn't it? Fame costs, and here's where you start sweating, or
Right,
whatever it is, the quote, paying in sweat. It's kind of like that. But I do think that's how the Chinese Room have made the games they've made, is by having someone really pushy
Well,
behind them going, this has to be right.
yeah, exactly. And I read recently about how demanding you were in a good way for the art in Rapture and making sure that even the flowers were the right ones for the particular season.
Yeah, and that was a big argument at the time, Kate. That was a really uncomfortable, the team had accidentally made daffodils, which, as come out in January and February, and our game was set in June. I was like, you don't get daffodils in June. And people were like, oh, but, and of course I understand the other side, which is an art team who are under an immense amount of pressure. It's one of 2,000 whatever assets that they've got to make for this game. Things, there are always compromises, but I also believe you should have someone on a team going, no, sorry, it's not happening. Because my mum's a writer, and she taught me from a really, really young age that if something is off in a television, she's a television writer, if there's one thing that jars visually for the audience, if it's not right, say if it's set in the 1980s, and you had a I don't know, an Apple Mac in it, and you kind of go, oh, that's wrong. And if it takes your attention away from what's happening, it ruins the credibility in the whole scene, and you've lost your audience. And I felt that was a really important lesson that I learned very early on.
Yeah, and even it's the kind of thing where as you're playing the game, you might not notice it, but in a kind of a subconscious level, you do. And so, especially if you go back and play it again and you notice the daffodils in June, and you're like, wait,
Yeah,
what?
you're like, ooh. And then you start not believing in the veracity of the world, and I think that's really important for me. So I'm just coming across as a completely tyrannical despot in this conversation. But yeah, it's important to me.
Yeah. Circling back to the music just a little bit, the story of So Let Us Melt covers billions of years. And as you were thinking about how to convey that in the music, did you like build it up to be more and more complex? Or what was the way that you conveyed all of that time, that span of time?
For me, the only way that I could do it without becoming too intellectual, and what I mean by that is having a response that doesn't feel natural to me, was to be scoring the scenes that were in front of me. So I really, the artist did a fantastic job in changing the geometry and the colors in the game. The palette changes as you go throughout. So in a way, they made it really easy for me to have a very naturalistic and emotional response to what I was actually seeing, and the pace of the game changes very much. So I kind of approached it in that way, which again was how I did Rapture, which Rapture was open world. So we had this really, really complicated, well, how do we know musically? What's the beginning, the middle, and the end when people can take so many different paths through this world? And I thought that way madness lies in a way. So the only way I could score my way through it was to say, what is the emotional response that I'm trying to elicit at this point in the game? And I think it works really well for So Let Us Melt, because I don't think you can, in a way, literally kind of go, this is 10 million years later, so how am I going to express that? So yeah, I took a very tonal approach, I suppose.
Yeah, and I love the blend of the electronic sounds in there too, because
Thank you. I was really nervous about that.
it's a really, really interesting blend because in a way it kind of supports the fact that this is an alien world and yet we're all used to synth sounds now, but the way that you blended them with the chorus and the instruments I think is really brilliant.
Thank you so much. I was a bit ner I mean, I was very nervous about it, and I was especially nervous because when you send all your stems over to the recording studio for them to prep, all the lot Pro Tools files and stuff, you send everything electronic, all the samples, totally dry. So in my head, and the way I'd got them set up in my demos, you know, they're very embedded within the orchestral and the choral setting. But I sent these extremely, you know, non-reverb, completely dry electronic samples over. And the lovely assistant, Tom, wrote back and said, I think you sent me the wrong things. These sound really weird and quite bad. And I was like, oh, no. I was like, no, I have sent the right things. And he was like, they're pretty crazy, Jess. Are you sure? You know, and he's not, he's a lovely guy. He's very, very honest. And I really trust him. And at that point, I thought, I'm not sure this is going to work. And then we didn't really talk about it during the recording phase because we were so busy and it was just a bit of a roast to try and get everything done. And then Jake Jackson, who's the incredible mixer and engineer who worked on the project, said, right, we need to talk about these samples. How do you hear these? Because I'm not getting it. And then I had to explain what was in my head and I played some of my demos. He's like, he had this sort of moment of epiphany. He was like, I understand. I get it. We can do this. We can do that. Oh, this is fantastic. And then just, you know, ran with it completely and really enhanced my vision of how I'd heard them in my head sounding, which is, of course, what great engineers do. And I think they work, but it was a bit of a leap of faith and so different for me again. I hadn't worked like that really before. So I'm glad you think they work.
Oh, they absolutely do. And I have to admit, I haven't played the game because I don't have a Google Daydream. So is the music pretty much the way you hear it on the soundtrack?
The music is pretty much the way you hear it on the OST. And I'm quite into that conceptually. And that was true of Rapture as well. And again, this is where I'm really lucky to work with Dan, who doesn't expect me to do, you know, completely stripped down versions for the game and then have a soundtrack that doesn't sound anything like in game, which, you know, you get quite a lot with game soundtracks. I've played one when I've heard the soundtrack first and then I play the game, I'm like, oh, hang on, this doesn't seem to bear any resemblance. I do tend to find that quite frustrating whilst completely understanding why that's the case. But because, you know, Dan's a writer, I'm a composer, we tell stories. We understand and we like to leave space for music. So I'm so fortunate. I really do feel very, very lucky as a composer to be given the opportunity to feature the music so strongly in the games that we make.
Yeah, especially with this one, it wouldn't be the same at all. It wouldn't be what it is without the music.
No, definitely. It kind of, it's such an immersive experience because it's VR and you have this music surrounding you. And we had a really nice new sound designer and he worked so beautifully on integrating the songs, and that's something you can't really get from the soundtrack, which works so well in the game. And he did a fantastic job. Is these songs that the machines sing to one another, and then you get the tiny drones singing with their really small voice, and then he, you know, engineered these amazing huge behemoth machines singing back, and that's really powerful. So I hope people play the game. Although one of the things we're finding is that not many people have a Google Daydream, and that's probably a very unpopular thing for me to say, but Google probably have me airlifted out for saying that. But at the moment, it's true.
Yeah, it's an interesting time for VR because there are all these different rigs that you can get, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, in a couple of years which ones really stick. But what's really cool, you brought up storytelling, and I think it's so neat that So Let Us Melt is going to be featured at the Future of Storytelling event in New York, October 6th through 8th. So even if someone doesn't have a Google Daydream, you can go and experience the game. And how did you guys get involved in that?
So Future of Storytelling asked Dan to go and speak at their conference last year, and it totally blew his mind. He came back, and he's already a man, as we all know, full of ideas. And he just said, I have just met the smartest creative minds in the world. They bring the most extraordinary people together from around the world and take them all to a really remote place and just set them going, basically. And I think it's a fantastic idea to get really high caliber people from all different walks of life. They have scientists there and politicians, musicians, architects, game designers. I mean, can you imagine? It's like a dream.
Yeah.
It's my nightmare to be surrounded by people who are far smarter than myself. But Dan took the challenge and rose to it. And we're in talks with an amazing theatre company in the UK who Dan met over there. So it was very, very fertile for Dan, especially. And yeah, so they have taken an interest in the Chinese Room ever since. So again, I think it's another organisation that really recognises the power of the mind and of creativity. And the games industry has been a very, very difficult, rough road for me. As a woman who's high profile, you get constant grief.
Yeah.
And what I'm planning on career-wise from now and the future is to surround myself with nurturing, caring people. And I think that has become probably my most important career strategy. It's not about ambition. It's not about size of projects. It's about saying, who do I want to spend my time with? Who do I want to work with? Who inspires me as a person as much as, you know, their creativity? It's about, especially the world and times that we're in at the moment, saying, this is where I'm planting my flag. This is who I'm aligning myself to.
Yeah. And speaking of that, Dan recently had an interview with Eurogamer that the studio's taking a break. And I can absolutely understand why, because I'm sure you had no idea how huge and how much recognition Dear Esther was going to get. And it sounds like you guys have been working just nonstop for 5 years, and it's been super intense.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We made Dear Esther, and then we put it onto Steam. And then that first night, we watched these figures go up and up and up. And we were just, all of a sudden, we were running a games company. And it sounds crazy to say it to you, but we didn't even look at each other and really have a conversation going, so do we run a games company now, darling? We just kind of started doing it. And we have been on that roller coaster ever since, and it has brought the most amazing things into our life, and it has definitely brought some of the most awful, I have to be honest, and challenging things into our life. I think Dan and I had a really long conversation this morning about social media and the access that people have to you, and when they're anonymous, they say things to you that they would never have the courage to say to your face. And we have, as a studio, been slaughtered by these people. And it's sad to say it, but I also want to be really honest about it, because I think it's a conversation that societally we need to be having. That we're a studio who we've never, you know, we are politically active and we are quite opinionated, and that brings a lot of positive and negative attention. And so I think we need a break from that. We are quite exhausted by the barrage of negative attention that we get. on Twitter and Facebook, and people downvoting our games, you know, pretending they've played them when they haven't, changing our Wikipedia page, doxing us. These are serious things. Jeez. And the other thing is that Dan and I, creatively, we never stop, which is amazing. But we looked at each other sort of probably around March, April this year, and Dan wasn't very well. I was really ill. And we just said, I think we need a rest. I think we need a serious rest. And when you have a company that costs £40,000 a month to run, it's not easy to take a rest, Kate, because you're bleeding money and you're seeing the account go down by tens of thousands of pounds a month. And we'd been offered projects that we didn't really want to do, that we could have done to keep the lights on and would have brought in some money. But we always said, it was the first thing we did say when we started making games together, if this stops being fun, and if we can't make the things we want to make that we feel passionate about, we're not going to do it anymore. And although it feels like the right thing to do, it's really hard to let go, even temporarily. And we don't know how long the break is going to be. We just need to regenerate, relax, calm down, and take a pause.
Yeah. And I can totally understand that maybe, well, as Dan said, he doesn't want to make walking simulators anymore, or for a while anyway. And I can understand that. You don't want to get stuck in a rut or pigeonholed into a particular kind of a game. Of
course, and that's something you hear time and time again, isn't it? I'm sure when you interview people, it's like with actors or with composers, they get known for that one role or that one style. And then that's all everyone wants from you. And they don't quite trust that you can or understand that you can do anything else. And I think that's been a frustration for Dan. You know, he's so super smart. He invented a genre. We know that he can do other stuff, but that has been one of the frustrations, is that people do want you to keep making the same thing. And most creative people want to keep challenging themselves in different ways. So I'm excited and terrified in equal measures to see what the next few months bring for us.
I can imagine. I mean, it's kind of like being on a cliff edge, I suppose.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it is. And going, this could be amazing, or, you know, it could be a complete unmitigated disaster. But I'm very bad at change, and I have to remind myself. My mum always says to me, everything changes even when you don't want it to. And I think it's a really good motto for living, actually, going, actually, you have to adapt and you have to move on. And that chapter has, I think, closed for us in some ways. And I think the world has changed. And I think the way people pay for things and buy things or don't has changed. You know, streaming's changed a huge amount for me in terms of the revenue or not that my music can bring in. And there are new challenges facing all, you know, music creators, publishers, novelists, theatre, everything is up for grabs at the moment. And that's equally exciting and it's a bit of a brave new world, I think, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the worst thing you could do as a studio is not change, because you need to keep up and keep reinventing yourself. So I think it's going to be a well-earned rest for you guys, but also a chance to, have a think about what you really want to do.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Can I come and live with you?
Oh, sure.
Can you be like an artist retreat?
Absolutely. You can set up down by our pond. And
that sounds really nice, actually. Can you just look after me so I'm ready to come out?
Oh, sure.
Hibernation. That's brilliant. Now, this has been on the radio, so that deal is now official.
Okay.
You can't renege on it.
I'll send you your ticket.
Thank you. And the bill. Right. It's a very expensive, exclusive retreat.
Well, tea and biscuits at 4 and the whole thing.
So. Absolutely. Oh, yeah, I expect the full-on treatment.
Oh, Jess, it's, as always, it's just been so much fun to chat. And I really look forward to what's ahead for you. And I know we'll have a chance to talk again. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always such a pleasure to be asked informed, intelligent questions. You always have thought about it. And it's always really appreciated, Kate. Thank you.